Now we're going to change pace a little bit for the next half hour, and I've got in front of me a man that the Financial Review did a story on him the other day and said he's the most positive man that they've met. And I've got to say that the dealings I've had with Victor Purden, he's a very positive man. So first of all, welcome, Victor.
Alan, it is such a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you too. Victor, I've just got to briefly ask you, how did you get that title from the Financial Review? Because that's a pretty good title to get.
They went beyond that. They called me the guru of optimism.
Oh, the guru?
The guru of optimism. So it's a funny story. The Luke Benedictus, the journalist, was asked to write about optimism.
Right.
And the more research he did, the more he worked out that one of the world's experts and one of the world centres was in Melbourne. So
did he?
Me and the Centre for Optimism. And it was a lovely interview. I mean, it was meant to go for half an hour. We ended up 2 hours together.
Yeah.
And I was on tape the whole time. So if I'd been naughty or stupid, it was on tape. And then the journalist, the photographer, then asked me to come up to Monbulk to a field of flowers.
Oh,
and
right.
She spent 2 hours.
Was it a tulip farm?
No, it was actually different flowers.
Yep.
I'm just having a mental blank. Why am I having a mental blank on
Doesn't
that
matter.
One? And she was looking for that right picture because it needed to be done for a magazine.
Yep.
So a magazine standard. And 2 hours walking up and down the hill in these field of flowers. And it's come out with me with my hands up, wearing a Samoan shirt, looking happy. So you couldn't, you know, sometimes we're always a bit suspicious of the contemporary media, but I could not have asked for a more beautiful article.
I've got to ask you first up, and I know I've talked to you about this before on air, what makes Victor Purden such an optimistic man?
Look, really, the more I think about it, the more it goes back generations. You know, my grandmother was in the Gulag for 12 years but never gave up. My parents were refugees. My mother, a refugee twice, widowed twice, then kept working to the age of 92.
Still kept going.
Yeah, with joy and contentment. So I think I've got, you know, really good examples, particularly my grandmother and my mother, but really, you know, the great-grandparents and the likes. They lived through invasion. Yeah, the people of Ukraine now are living through Russian invasion.
Yep.
You know, my ancestors in the 1850s. We're living through the same sort of stuff. So so I think there's that. And then coming back to this passion for optimism, I'd been working overseas in the Americas and work was easy because people, you know, the person people want to have a beer with after work is an Aussie.
Yep.
And
yep.
then I worked on the G20 presidency and exactly that super elite level of presidents and prime ministers and finance. It was the same. And then I got back to Melbourne and I was stunned by the negativity.
Certainly the last few years, there's been a lot of negativity, hasn't there?
So, you know, we started a research project on Australian leadership. Why were people so negative on leadership? Because everyone mocks their politicians.
Yep.
But the Australian antipathy towards leadership was much broader. And then at the end of the
we're talking business leaders now,
business
too.
Leaders, church leaders, Boy Scout leaders, probably radio station leaders.
Yeah.
And so at the end of the 2 years, we were still left puzzled. You know, because Bill George from Harvard, I interviewed him.
Yeah.
He said, you got nothing to worry about, Vic. Australian leadership's really good. And my eureka moment came at the end of 2017 at the Global Integrity Summit, where it was 3 days of misery.
Yeah.
And I changed my speech on the last panel to the case for optimism, and it electrified the room. And Helen Clark, who was then the head of the United Nations Development Program, the ex-New Zealand Prime Minister, said, Victor, turn that into a book. And I will endorse it. So I did, she did. And from that day on, every day I ask people, what makes you optimistic?
So, Victor Purden, we're talking about now yourself.
Yeah.
Do you ever have any mornings when you get up and you think, oh, it's a drag today? Or do you bounce out of bed every day? Because it must be hard every day to bounce out of bed.
Every morning, I tend to have a cup of coffee about 5 in the morning.
Right.
And I sit down and read my optimism clippings.
Oh, do you?
So I've got 1,000 alerts on Google Alerts.
Right.
And everything from the economy plus optimism or optimistic or cancer treatment, optimism, optimistic. So that comes in, maybe 20 or 30 emails come in and I take a coffee and I get the latest scientific reports. Right. Yeah, there was one yesterday from Germany on malignant melanoma and how in their study, survivors of malignant melanoma who are optimistic live better. And they then went on to say we need to teach people how to be more optimistic. So I start every day with about an hour of reading stuff on optimism.
It's strange that you say that, but, it's not strange, but I do know that out of the people that I've known that's had cancer, the people that have lasted the longest, I can't say they've gone on forever, but the ones that have lasted longer, who are the ones that have said, I'm going to beat this and I'm going to do this, as opposed to a person who says, oh, I've had it now.
No, you are spot on. The evidence, Harvard University, who are in the news today, of course,
yep.
Harvard, Boston University, the American military, who did a big study on this, Vienna Medical School, the American Heart Association, they actually say that optimism is the key protective trait against cancer, against heart disease, against dementia. Yeah. Now, people will still get it,
yeah.
But particularly for the doctors who work in cancer and cardiology,
yep.
Optimism is the key predictor that people will survive the treatment.
True. Victor, I don't want to get into politics on this show. We never have and we never will. But how much does politics, because politics would be part, how much of that depends... rubs off on us, like whether we're positive or negative. And I don't want to talk parties or anything. I just want to talk about the actual political scene.
Yeah. Look, I still remember George Bush the second saying that the job of the American president is to be the optimist in chief, that the country wants optimistic leaders. And Gallup, you know, the big research institute, 2 weeks ago published a study called What Followers Want. And 52 countries, absolutely every country, people want positive leaders with a great vision. So I think in Australia, the politicians don't bring us down. I think they are a symptom. And I was thinking this yesterday, you know, you watch the news, I actually think they've contracted out policy making to the news. So everything is a crisis and they're reacting to crisis. So they've got almost identical policies. You know, one's got a tax deduction, you know, one's got a direct subsidy. But I think for me, having been in politics for many decades, the disappointment for me is we're letting the news services run politics.
They always set the agenda.
Yeah.
Victor, how much, and I want to get away from politics.
Yeah, of course.
Because I just don't want, but how much of... When you're in politics, you were there for a long while, so we're not talking party politics, we're talking a politician. How much of vision do you actually have as far as 10, 20 years away? Because in 3 or 4 years, you've got to go to the polls again. So how much vision, like out of your thoughts, how much of it would be, come on, I've got to get re-elected in 3 years, but down 20 years, I'd like to aim there. How much is short-term as opposed to long-term?
Yeah, I was lucky because I was a member for Doncaster, so it was a relatively safe Liberal seat, and it became safer the longer I was there.
Yep.
And so I was able to do the big stuff. I mean, people who are old enough to remember the early days of the internet and, you know, those funny sounds we had when we connected. So I was... Victoria then had the world's first multimedia agency. We were really looking 10, 20, 30 years ahead.
Right.
In the water sector, as you know, I'm on the board of Yarra Valley Water, on Vic Water. You know, you've got to plan 20 and 30 years ahead. And, you know, in Healesville, where you've got some of the best drinking water in Australia... You know, those aqueducts were laid by people 100 years ago.
Yeah, and they tell me they're still usable, like they're still what they want.
Well, I gave a speech the other day and my son had sent me a photo the day before from Spain.
Yep.
And it was a Roman aqueduct that has been serving a community for 1,900 years. So when you look at Melbourne and this, you know, I've got a glass of water on the desk here, you know, the... closed catchments, which are so close to where we're broadcasting from, you know, you drink the water, it comes through the taps pristine and beautiful and tastes fantastic. Well, of course, that was all planned and laid out by people 100 years ago. So I think, you know, if you think of water and energy and the like, both sides of politics still have to think 50 and 100 years ahead. The problem is the squabbling they're doing is the end of 2025.
I've got to take a quick break because some of this stuff's going to disappear if I don't. So I'll just take a quick break. I'm talking to Victor Purton, and Victor was the guru of positivity in the Financial Review, and he is. He's a very, very optimistic man, Victor Purton. So we're talking a bit about it. Victor, so let's just get off the politics angle that we're talking about. Now, how does something like when COVID came the first time – this interview is not about me, but I want to ask you this. When COVID first came along, we all thought, oh, the world's coming to an end here. Then after 2 years, I mean, I've had COVID four times. So now when I hear about COVID, I'm not particularly worried about it and I'll get over it. I hope I will. So how did the mood swing a bit like me, or was I just a different? We all thought the world not necessarily going to come to an end, but we all got very depressed, and then now we just don't care. Is that a fair comment, or am I just wrong?
No, Victoria, the Victorian psyche is still damaged by that.
Is it?
The resistance to government regulation, people ignoring government health advice.
Well, particularly the second long lockdown, didn't they? We had a permit to work, and I noticed the first one, there were very few cars on the road. The second long term, they didn't all have permits, I can guarantee. So people just refused, did they?
Yeah. I think that Victorians, and particularly Melburnians and people in Hillsville, pretty resilient.
Yep.
However, I don't think we get enough credit from people as to what we endured.
Yep.
And how well we endured it. So, you know, like people came up with all sorts of tricks, like, you know, standing on the front fence of the neighbour to have a glass of wine together. Yep. And, you know, our street, we've got a most wonderful WhatsApp group that has persisted. You know, we share news and the like. So I think there were many benefits from COVID.
Yep.
However, I still think there's a residual, and you see it particularly in young people.
Yep.
You know, they lost a couple of years of socialisation.
Yeah, absolutely.
So a 17 or an 18-year-old has not endured that interaction with other people for almost a year, even a bit longer than that. So I think that persists. And you see it now in some of the studies on optimism.
Right.
So Victorian young people are still optimistic for themselves,
right,
but they're very bleak for the country and the world.
Are they?
And that's one of the things we've got to work on.
Yep.
Because if, you know, there was a lovely study by National Australia Bank on secondary school students that was published last week. I actually met with the head of behavioural science at NAB yesterday.
Oh, right.
And what's interesting is if you ask young people, they do want to set up their own businesses. They do want to be entrepreneurs. So there's still that I can do stuff and I can do. But if you really want to do stuff and succeed in the world, you've got to make the whole world your oyster.
Yeah.
And that bleakness about the country and the bleakness of the world is worrying. And as you might remember, I sponsor the Nelson Mandela Youth Leadership Summit, which is on Nelson Mandela Day, the 18th of July. Yep. And this time round, we're going to have a whole session on democracy and Mandela because, there's this concern that there's declining confidence in democracy.
Yeah.
The stuff says that people who are most dissatisfied with their own lives are the most dissatisfied with democracy.
Are they?
And the OECD, you know, the Organisation of Economic Cooperation and Development, which Matthias Cormann now heads, their studies of young people show that optimism is the key determinant of life satisfaction.
Do they?
So if you're out there, if you're a grandparent or a parent, the Dalai Lama would say, you can't tell a teenager to be optimistic.
No.
You've got to model it. So tonight, when you see your grandchild or your child, start the conversation with, I had the most fantastic day today. I did X or I did Y or I listened to Alan and Victor on the radio. They were so fascinating. What was the best thing in your day? So a lot of families will get the kids, what was the best thing in your day at the dinner table? Yep. I'd urge parents and grandparents to try this. You go first. You be the model. You be the exemplar. Because if we want our democracy to thrive, we need people to be optimistic about it.
So are you saying that the parent, the grandparent should be one that leads or the child that leads?
No, the grandparent or the parent.
Right. So often with kids they want to do their own thing, but I know that... Yeah, I remember you telling me from, because I do listen to what people say. I remember you saying that even when you go to a coffee, get a coffee down at your favourite place in Bay Street, that you often say to the barista, you know, what's the best thing that's happened to you today? Whereas a lot of people walk in, so coffee please, and take it and walk out. So I guess. And now I'm going to ask you a personal question here. When you ask that, apart from the girl or the guy, I shouldn't say girl, that's a barista, apart from them hopefully feeling happy that this guy is interested in what I did, does that make you feel all the happier too when they come back to you with something good?
It's spectacular. I went to one of the universities the other day. I was giving a speech.
Yep.
And at reception, the young lady said, how are you? And I said, well, I'm splendid, thank you. Tell me the best thing in your day today. Five people working behind her all looked up and her boss said, God, that's a good question.
Because no one bets ask her that all day.
No one. And the lady in my supermarket, you know, says to me, you're my favourite customer. Sometimes at 7 in the morning, Mr. Purton, you're asking me a bit early. It lifts people. If anyone would like to try this experiment for the rest of the week, just imagine me slapping my forehead and you saying, how are you? And someone says, not bad or not too bad. God, what a waste of a question, what a waste of an answer. Just try today or tomorrow, just what's been the best thing in your day?
Don't ask, what you're saying is this right? Don't ask them.
How are you?
How are you?
Yeah, because say, what's been the best thing in your day?
Because everyone's going to say all right, aren't they? Yeah.
No, most people say not bad or not too bad.
Yeah, that's true.
65% of Australians answer not bad or not too bad.
Right. Whereas if you ask them what...
best thing in your day, most people will have a little story to share. Now, you do it all day on the radio, so you get the best out of people. Yep. But I'd love your listeners to try this experiment. We did it in prison. It was so...
when were you in prison?
Oh, I wasn't in prison, but I was teaching the prisoners. It was so powerful. I mean, just imagine a five times murderer looking you in the eye and saying, what's been the best thing in your day? You could be the toughest warder. You're still going to answer that question. It so changed the power balance between the prisoners and the warders. We were asked to come back and train the general managers of prisons.
Were you?
In more positive communication.
So, Victor, on a personal note, like, you not only go out and do, like, you've often said you've done this speech and that speech, so you often go out and actually, not so much practice, but teach people how to be optimistic, do you?
Well, as you know, I've just come from the sewage plant in Healesville, and I was honoured last week. I was the opening keynote speaker for the Water Operators Conference, which are the people who run the sewage plants and run the operators. So I do a lot of that. My proudest thing was actually last October, I went to CHOGM, you know, the Commonwealth Heads of Government, and you'd be proud of me. I didn't wear a dark suit. I wore my Samoan shirt and my Technicolor Crocs. Yeah. And through the week, I pressed and pressed and pressed, and I was so overjoyed. Second last day, the Secretary General of the Commonwealth thanked the King.
Yep.
For his optimistic advice. And then the final communique was that the heads of government commit to restoring optimism in our common future.
Gee, that's terrific, isn't it?
Well, they recognise it's a problem. Yeah. And in fact, since you and I last met, the World Economic Forum, which meets in Davos in January, they have a risk register. What are the biggest risks to the world? Their number one risk was declining optimism.
Was it?
So the world business leaders are getting this problem, that we older folk have got to take up our duty and help the younger people to be more optimistic about the world.
I was just going to ask you that question. Out of the age group, which is the most optimistic and which is the least optimistic?
People who are older tend to be more optimistic.
Yep.
And that's because we've gone through the tough stuff.
Yep.
Optimism comes from toughness. It's not la-di-da, you know. Yep. Viktor Frankl, you know, the German psychotherapist who came through the Holocaust and wrote Tragic Optimism.
Yep.
You know, it comes from the tough stuff.
Yep.
And you become more resilient and stronger, and you understand that, you know, the verbal mistake you make today is going to be forgotten by other people tomorrow.
Yep.
There was a lovely lady called Edna who died at the age of 107. And she was interviewed by Seb Costello on A Current Affair, and they, how have you lived so long? She said, I'm an optimist. I never worry about yesterday because I can't change it.
Yep.
I never worry about tomorrow because I know whatever I do today, the sun's going to rise tomorrow. So older people tend to be the most optimistic, and the more optimistic an older person is, the longer and better life they are likely to live. And there's a wonderful Israeli study that actually looked at people aged 85.
Yeah.
And the lifespan difference between the optimists and the pessimists was astounding.
Was it?
You want to live life... Like Henry Kissinger, of course, was still working to the age of 99.
Yep.
You know, so if you've still got purpose...
Yep.
And you're in your 90s, you are likely to live a good life. Oh. But if you're miserable about life, you're going to give up.
So... So the next group down, from the older people down, are they all not as optimistic, or are there various levels that, say, when you're 30, 50s and 40s or that sort of stuff?
Well, some people like you and me, it's just we're just obnoxiously optimistic all our lives.
It's going to be.
Young people tend to be very positive.
Yep.
So positivity is different from optimism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because optimism is a belief that good things will happen and that things will work out in the end. You know, and if you're 17 and you've been in a rowing race and you've lost, or you didn't make the AFL selection criteria, you know, it's this bleakness and, oh, my God, how will I survive this?
Yep.
Whereas you and I know... We put in a job application, we don't get it. We put in the next one.
Yep, keep moving on.
And it's that persistence. So I think we learn persistence.
Yep.
So mostly there is a dip in optimism for men, particularly in their mid-40s.
Is there?
So when you realise you're not going to be the chairman of the board or you're not going to be the CEO and you've got to recalibrate, Yep. Where you're going to go in life. And then there's another period in the late 60s, you know, when you get a bad knee or a bad back. Or
we all get them.
Yeah, and everyone's got their pains. But, yep, you know, most people get to their 60s,
yep,
without lots of aches and pains. And there's that period,
yep,
where you realise you're a bit more fragile, where it dips again.
Yep.
But then it tends to go upwards and upwards again, yep, in your 70s and your 80s. And, you know, the grandparent or great-grandparent in their 90s that everyone remembers. And there's a really lovely, lovely study, again, that Gallup study.
Yep.
Where do people find their most positive leaders, Alan?
I don't know.
65% find them in their family.
Do they?
Yeah. That's not the boss at work.
And it's not
the prime minister. It's not the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
Right? It's actually their father, their mother, their grandparent, their uncle. Most people find the most inspiring leader in their life in their household.
In their own family.
And so we should all think about that influence that we have. And yep, sometimes I'm quite naughty. I visit offices and the like. Before my speech, I write on the mirror, "The leader looks like the person in your mirror." So those who are listening at home, get your lipstick out or your indelible marker and put it on your mirror. The leader looks like the person in this mirror.
I never thought of that.
Everyone's a leader.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and in their own family and whatever.
It's a fascinating result. We actually replicated that in Australia 2015-16, but we weren't sure that that was global. But when I saw the Gallup results, quite clear, most people find their most inspiring leadership in their family.
Yeah. It's been terrific having you along again. Pardon, Victor. And we're going to get you back to talk about on another subject in May. But I think we went, and in parts I still think, pardon me, there are a lot of people out there at the moment that aren't as positive as what they could be.
Yeah. And they're scared. I mean, you watch the news, right? Yep. The news tries to make you scared. It tries to make you anxious. It tries to make you fearful. It tells you everything's a crisis or everything's an emergency. And, sometimes you just got to switch it off.
What you said before, and I think you said it about the 106-year-old lady or whatever it was, no matter what happens today, and we're coming into an election, doesn't matter who wins, we all have our own preference. The end of the day on the Sunday morning, we'll get up and the sun will still shine, won't it?
And 90% of what the government does won't change.
No.
You know, we're still going to pay our pensions. We're still going to run a military. We're still going to have a federal police.
Yep.
We're still going to have the National Emergency Management Agency. We're still going to have ASIO. All of the stuff will continue. The actual differences are not that great, but they are heavily contested in an election. Oh, and I love watching the ads, Alan. I get funnier and funnier.
Oh, I get sick of it. but that's true. Victor, unfortunately, I've got to go. Thank you for your time yet again, and we'll certainly talk to you in May.
Well, it's been wonderful to be back here in Healesville. And as you know, I've been watching the most basic functions of humanity today.
We won't go with that. Thanks, Victor.